Auld Lang Syne, Scottish dialect for old, long since, or more gracefully translated, of days gone by. A song so nostalgic that it can cut through the noise and merriment of a New Year's Eve party like a melodious knife. I heard it first as a child, wondering at the look on my parents' faces when they sang it, having no knowledge of the long reach of their memories, unable to see the lost faces they were seeing, but able to hear the melancholia in their voices when they sang the haunting lyrics. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? The practical answer, much of the time, is yes, so that we can get on with our lives. But the answer sometimes is no, because if we never look back, there is no way to look forward to anything worth having. The apostle said in that verse you heard a moment ago, forgetting what is behind me, reaching out for what lies ahead, I press on. But he speaks only half the truth. Some things do need to be forgotten, and one has to go on with all the hope and courage one can muster. But other things have to be remembered, or the house of the future is built on sand. So on this quiet Sunday, after the hubbub of Christmas, in a reflective mood, I call upon you to remember your own childhood, if you left it quite a while back. Can you remember how gracious time was to you when you were a child? Summer lasted forever. The days were long and lazy and golden. My recollections are surely distorted, but I know that I read books on any given day for hours. I practiced pitching for hours more with a friend who was patient and willing to sacrifice his hands. I swam for hours in the cool waters of Greenwood Lake. And then there would still be the stretched out summer evenings for running on the empty road in front of my house at the edge of town. Never tired, never out of time, the days were at least 72 hours long, with time for everything. Now the summers go by so fast I can hardly catch my breath. Between the spring teaching term and the one that starts in late August, and in the world of my church, between one Christmas and the next. My son-in-law, who was here on Christmas Eve, came to my house that morning, found me at the typewriter, and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "You won't believe this, but I'm working on next year's Christmas sermon. There were some things I couldn't use this year, and I didn't want to let them get away." He looked at me the way any sane man would, as if I were hopeless, and he said, "You may not even be alive next year." He's always encouraging about that. How could I explain to him that he would leave and I would turn around and do a couple of things and it would be next Christmas already? We came into this house in mid-June, but already it seems entangled with our keenest memories. Children born and baptized, ask the Lysons and the Gilbronsons and the Silvertooths, our first couple married when Mike Pepoon and Debbie Gann spoke their promises. Our first farewell since we've been in this house to an immediate member of the family, when Paul's wife and Jack's mother, Nedra Galbraith, became last week a fragrant memory instead of a living presence. What it means, dear friends, is that our history has truly begun. And on Thursday night, at a minute past 12, our first full year in the White Church will begin. You may be almost too tired to think about it, because the holidays can wear you out, even when they are wonderful. Some of you must have read the newspaper letter last week about the little girl who had gotten caught in the crossfire of her family's frantic preparations for Christmas. They became irritable and short. They scolded her for getting in the way and for crying when she was tired. And finally, they packed her off to bed. She was praying the Our Father who art in heaven, half asleep already. And she got confused about that odd word, trespasses, so that what came out was the real truth. Forgive us our Christmases as we forgive those who Christmas against us. What a mixture of things Christmas is, with the family getting together and then separating, with the lights and the giving and the music and the music and the music and the music, until late on Christmas night you switch the channels frantically trying to find a station not playing Christmas music, because by then you've had enough. And then almost before you've caught your breath, there is this Sunday, the last Sunday of the year, when there is a brief hiatus of quiet before the parties and the merriment, sometimes a little forced, of New Year's Eve. It probably is a good time to be reflective, and that's what I plan to be this morning, in words that are meant to prompt your reflections, so that if you get a glazed and faraway look in your eyes during this sermon, it's the right response. It won't be a long sermon anyway, contrary to what a young man said when he walked in to his father. He looked at the bulletin and said, "Uh-oh, Dad, the shorter the title, the longer the sermon." And this one only has two words in the title. The sermon isn't much longer than that. Friday night, Christmas night, with the bachelor son fast asleep on the floor by the fireplace and all the others gone off to be with other family, Billy and I sat in the living room with only the tree lights blinking and did what parents do all over the world, talked quietly of the beloved lives that had just swirled around us. I noticed all of a sudden a strange little blue light in the string of white lights that had been wrapped around a large plant. Something foreign, out of place, not there that morning. I said, "How did that get there?" And knew the answer even before I finished the question. One of the curious young minds had wondered how it would be if a blue light were removed from one string and inserted into the dull unity grandfather had created. And busy little fingers had promptly gone to work and made it happen. I said something about the boy child needing to leave his mark, like a puppy on a tree, to say, "I've been here." And both of us marveled how it could happen without our seeing it happen, until we remembered how children know when adults are talking that it's possible to sit right under their noses and restructure the whole house without their noticing. It was midnight by then, and as I relaxed on the couch, smiling at that intruding blue light, reminiscent somehow in the name of its color of the name of the culprit, I got to thinking about something Martin Marty wrote once about holiday visits and the ways of time. And you need to be secure in your love for one another to hear this. They come, he said, about the children. They come bringing cheer and gifts and love. They stay, leaving their socks on the floor, the ornament broken, the beds unmade, their parents happy and nettled, as always. They then head for their homes, taking and leaving behind cheer and gifts and love and relief. That, he says, is the standard script. They are the 30-year-olds visiting the 55-year-olds, sharing the small typhoons that are their own children, or else they are the 55-year-olds visiting the 80-year-olds for the holidays. It became fashionable a few years ago, Dr. Marty recalls, for the seniors to talk much in public with ease and relief about the kids leaving the nest. There would be a cosmic sigh in place of the guilt that for generations parents carried when the nest emptied, guilt at feeling selfish about their enjoyment of each other and of order and quiet when the young had spread their wings and sailed a little awkwardly to a tree down the block, and they were left to themselves. But a few years ago, it suddenly became humane and even Christian to feel freed up and to say so. At parties, parents, with almost compulsive urgency, not too hard to see through, started saying things like, well, it's fun to see them come and it's fun to see them go. Or, we do like to see them, but when their car turns around in the driveway, we breathe a sigh of relief, hug each other in front of the fire, and enjoy our aloneness together. You still hear that at parties, and you will for some time yet, wherever cultural lag is strongest and people need to say smart things. But if you listen closely to your own heart, you hear a bit of forced humor and gaiety in those conversations. They have that ring of New Year's Eve joy at the edge of death revelry, as right and proper as it is for young people to lead their own lives and be their own persons, and as enjoyable as it is for parents to lead their own lives without demands and dependencies, still the goodbyes at the end of the year are bittersweet. They are followed by silence, and for a split second at least, a sense of the void. A sense that party chatter and smiles cannot dispel. You say, I'm sure we'll hear you in the morning, early when you take off, and you do hear them, and you are suddenly sorry you let them talk you into staying in bed while they slipped off at 5 so as not to bother you anymore. You stand at the door when the auto coughs and the horn beeps, the family farewell signal, or you watch the jet lift off the snow-covered runway and head west. And what you know, deep inside, is that these goodbyes are always more than just goodbyes. What you know is that every goodbye is a practice run at dying, that the last enemy has sent these good friends and these beloved family as advance representatives. Every parting, however mixed with relief and sadness, is a thinly disguised rehearsal for the final parting. Which is why, of course, if there is a gift to give, you give it now. If forgiveness is asked by a word or a sign, you offer it now. If there is a word of love to say, you say it now. You don't wait. So it is that the farewells, squeezed from a hug at the door, shouted one last time from the car window, force upon us a realism that somebody will try to disguise on New Year's Eve in the party chatter, saying ever so brightly, thank God, tomorrow they'll be gone. And you think, tomorrow? They will. Thank you.